Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Liskov. And with me today, back again for another West Wing episode, is Joe Reed, host of This Had Oscar Buzz, managing editor at theprimetimer.com. He's here to talk about the White House Pro-Am. And my first question to you is this. Do you know why the hell this episode is called the White House Pro-Am?
I jotted that down too. To my best guess, this is one of the more... It's not even that it's an esoteric title. It's just one of those that, like, if it were in Latin, we could understand it. Because it was just like, it's Aaron Sorkin. Right. He likes to do Latin titles, whatever. Right. Post hoc, ergo, propter hoc. Sure.
Sure.
No, my guess is because one of the things when Sam and Abby have their little meeting is that he calls her and her office amateurish.
Right.
And that, like, the idea of a pro-am being, like, a pro-am tournament is, like, professionals and amateurs. So, like, the idea that, like, the conflict between the Bartlett staff and the Abbey staff is professionals versus amateurs. But, like, it's a real, real tenuous connection. And, like, I really wonder at what point he came up with that and was just like, no, we're sticking with it. Like, I will hear no other, like, whatever. Or, like, maybe it was Lawrence O'Donnell or someone like that. Like, who the hell knows? But, like, knowing Aaron Sorkin, it was probably Aaron Sorkin.
I was just racking my brain being like, I've heard the terminology pro-am before, but I couldn't really figure out how it associated with it. Anyway.
It's one of the least when you, it's one of the worst titles for remembering what was in the episode, because
yes,
you're just like, okay, this tells me nothing. This gives me absolutely nothing. And The West Wing isn't great about that. It's not like, I think the ideal are shows like Seinfeld and Friends, where they tell you exactly
the pertinent info.
Yeah. Usually, I will say. Because like, the one where Ross got high is not about Ross getting high. It's about Rachel baking a trifle with meat and peas. And like, that's like, whatever. That's a whole other conversation. But like, West Wing, like those titles, and it's not just a Sorkin thing, because it would definitely continue into the John Wells era, where I just like, you look at some of those titles and you're just like, okay, but what happens in this episode? Just like, why don't you just tell me what happens in this episode?
Yeah, I do like a title that makes you think, but this one makes me think too much and makes me like go like, what? Yeah.
But and doesn't give you a satisfying sort of aha moment.
This is an interesting episode, because I felt like it's a little bit of treading water in some of the storylines.
In some of the storylines,
and then some storylines, it is moving the ball forward a little bit. You know, we're now sort of approaching, I just want to remember, I want to see which number it is. It's number 17 of 22. So
it's two episodes before Let Bartlett Be Bartlett, which is, I feel like, where the season like congeals, clicks into endgame mode.
Yes.
Like, so it's,
Let Bartlett Be Bartlett really launches you into the final three episodes of the season, and you're really starting to get a sense of...
And it's a mission statement episode. It really, like, it's one of those episodes that tells you that, like, we've been paying attention to the way things have been going, too. Like, we've been paying attention to all the little failures that have been happening along the way. So, like, that's cool. And this episode doesn't really play into that as much. I think you're right. I think you're not incorrect about the treading water thing.
Well, it's not that it's interesting. So I think that it's actually an interesting comparison with Let Bartlett Be Bartlett, because I do feel like this episode is a little bit of trying to do something with this child labor trade bill sort of situation that they're in.
Yeah.
And there is sort of a futility in it to a certain degree. Like, they think they've got this thing locked down.
Right.
But like everything in politics, and especially within this administration, it feels like everything is sort of tenuous. And I think that that tenuous component really sort of codifies. And that's when the Let Bartlett Be Bartlett thing happens, where it's like, we're past tenuous now. We're now at a place where we're just not achieving anything anymore.
And yet, by all indications, because like Abby gets Becky Reisman to pull her rider on the bill. So like, by all indications, the bill is still going to pass. We don't really get any like resolution on that at the end, but like, we can sort of assume. Yes. So it's not like they're taking an L in this, as they are in things like the Lowell Lydell thing, or the like certain other things that happen in the season, where they're just like, they put the sex education report in a drawer, those kinds of things. And this one, it's not like it's like another demoralizing defeat for the Bartlett White House, but it does sort of, it moves pieces along. I think obviously the reason why I asked for this episode was the last time I was on, it was the first Abby Bartlett episode. And this is the third of her three appearances in the first season. And this one is definitely my favorite. Like, their argument scene at the end of this episode is absolutely why I wanted to talk about this one, because it's so... good, and it's so like powerfully performed by the both of them, but especially Stalker Channing. Like, Stalker Channing, I've joked before that like Stalker Channing should have won a Tony Award for this episode, because it's like, it's very like, her theatrical voice is like really, really in service in this episode, and like, to beautiful effect as far as I'm concerned.
It's really interesting, because if you look at the three episodes, which is the first one being the state dinner, the second one is, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on the name of it?
It's He Shall From Time to Time.
Of course,
when he collapses and she tells Leo that he's got MS.
Yeah. Right, and then this one. Yep. It's a really interesting trifecta of sort of seeing the range of Abby's character.
Yes.
And what they sort of, what they learn about her, what they sort of unpack about her, and what will ultimately be what she becomes as she becomes a regular in season two, and really sort of start to really dig into Abby. I had Carrie Coorigan on to talk about an episode, and she brought up Dead Irish Writers as one of her favorite episodes.
Yeah.
And when you think about that scene, when you think about Abby, Donna, CJ, Amy Gardner sitting in that scene together,
great
and you
scene.
Actually, it's a great scene, and you get to see the breadth of what Aaron Sorkin is capable of when it comes to writing female characters when he applies himself.
You get a little less patient with some of the other stuff.
Right? But Abby just becomes such a three-dimensional, full-blooded character. So much of it obviously being in Channing's performance, but Stalker Channing's performance, that is. But it's interesting. It's interesting you pick this episode, because I do want to unpack the Abby of it all and how she plays into the bigger picture of the show. But I also sort of want to talk about the other... Let me give a synopsis real quick, and then we'll kind of dive into the things. The president and first lady's staffs feud over rival event agendas when her public statements about foreign child labor abuse inspires a Congresswoman Reisman, to attach an amendment that will surely torpedo a long-delayed international tariff bill favored by the president. What's more, when the revered chairman of the Federal Reserve dies, the president is under pressure to name the former head's top lieutenant as his successor, the same man who seriously dated the first lady in college. Away from the White House, Zoe clashes with her boyfriend Charlie when she suggests that he not step out together with her at an upcoming club opening at the request of the Secret Service, which is concerned about recent hate letters concerning their interracial relationship. Josh asks opinionated Toby to mind his manners prior to parlaying with important congressmen. The White House Pro-Am aired on March 22, 2000. It was written by Lawrence O'Donnell and Paul Redford and Aaron Sorkin. It was directed by Ken Olin. 15.76 million viewers tuned into the episode. There's a couple quotes I wanted to read real quick here. Alan Greenspan was troubled because about 2 months ago I killed the Fed chair with a heart attack and nobody on the show gave a damn that the guy was dead. That was Aaron Sorkin saying that. Then Janelle Maloney said, "Dirty little secret, I have a crush on Alan Greenspan. There's something kind of mythical about him. He's so powerful. He and his wife watched the show and I just thought, my God, Alan Greenspan is sitting on Wednesday nights watching me on TV." An interesting crush for Janelle Maloney to have.
When was that quote?
That quote was from like around this episode.
Around the time of the episode. That was sort of one of the things I was going to mention. So clearly the Fed chair and this is analogous to Alan Greenspan in real life. And I think at that time there was, I think because, you know, end of the Clinton administration, the economy was going very well. And obviously like pre-9/11, all this sort of stuff. It would have made sense that Alan Greenspan was a revered figure, was an at least incredibly respected figure.
Totally.
And so, but like, again, as with many of these West Wing things, now we look at it like post the economic collapse in 2008 and all of these things, like we don't have that much of a sunny look at Alan Greenspan. No. And that I thought was really interesting. Maybe Janelle Maloney really likes Andrea Mitchell or something like that.
It's very possible. I think it's interesting just that Alan Greenspan was a name that was known, right? Like the Fed chair was a thing that ultimately became known again when, you know, the economy cratered in 2008.
Right,
and everyone was like, who's going to save us from ourselves?
Right.
So there was that.
It's always a bad sign when like the names of the heads of financial institutions are well known. The fact that we all knew who Ben Bernanke was a terrible, terrible,
terrible
sign.
Terrible, terrible sign.
Yeah.
I would argue that it's never a good sign for us to know the heads of most government agencies.
I think that's very true.
The fact that we know who Dr. Fauci is not a great thing.
Right, right. Heck of a job, Brownie. Like, we don't like the fact that we knew that guy's name was really, really bad.
It comes back to something I was talking with a friend of mine about a little while ago, about how, you know, for 4 years we were so inundated with government that it became just truly exhausting to be that hyper aware of the government. The government, for all intents and purposes, in my mind, is something I really shouldn't be paying all that much attention to.
I'm with you there. And it's tough. It's been tough to turn that faucet off, like mentally.
Yes.
Like it's, you know, it's one of those things that I find myself having to force myself to be like, stop, like take a breath. If you like 2 days from now, this is not going to be the crisis that it seems to be right now. Not everybody's, you know, tweet about something is, you know, indicative. It's something you need to like dedicate your mental, you know, bandwidth to.
Well, yeah, it's I mean, I got so used to waking up in the morning, looking at my phone, and just having my heart sink just many times over.
Yeah,
it's something. It's definitely left scars for sure.
Yeah.
There's a quote from Rob Lowe that I think is funny too. He said, "I go to lunch at the gym every day to keep my energy up." And Aaron has always been fascinated by that. He always says, "How can you do that? You work so hard. How can you go to the gym at lunch?" The next thing I know, I get an episode where Sam's at the gym. Yeah. I think that's indicative of something that that I'm sure you've thought about, and I'm sure we've perhaps even spoken of. The idea of the writers trying to learn about the actors and what tools they have in their tool belts in order to make sure that we're doing stuff that feels second nature to them. You know what I mean? I think that anytime you can do that's a good thing.
Clearly, this is something that emanates off of Rob Lowe, because you think about Parks and Recreation and his character there. That was such a big part of that character, too, of just like this quest to be like, you know, the first human being to live to 150 years old, like that whole kind of thing. And so, like, clearly you spend enough time with Rob Lowe and you just sort of marvel at his physical condition. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, okay, that makes
sense. When he gets the flu, it's a tremendous episode of Parks and Rec. His staring at himself and saying, "Stop pooping," is one of
one of the great line readings in television history. Yeah, for sure.
I love this episode.
The scene where he has with Toby, where Toby literally looks at him, is just like, "How much healthier do you want to get?" Like, but yet when he leaves, Toby's like says to Josh, "Like, I got to get to the gym," or like something like that. It's just like, oh, okay. So clearly, like, Toby gets it.
For sure. Whenever you get a sense of of Toby's jealousy of Sam, it doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, you really get a sense of the
Toby's. Every once in a while, I'll look at one of my friends who's still in their 20s, and I'll just be like, "Your youth disgusts me." And I feel like that's a lot of, you know, Toby's reaction to Sam sometimes.
For sure. Yeah. He also, I mean, not to jump ahead to another episode, but Celestial Navigation is a perfect episode of Toby's annoyance at Sam's little picadillos and sort of oddities. Yes.
That's a great runner throughout the series.
He's like, "There really is something freakish about you." It's great. So we don't have any Mandy in this episode. I know you're.
I know. Is this
that.
The first time that that's happened? You've been going through them one by one. Is this the first? Yeah.
Yeah. This is.
The bells were ringing.
Yeah. The bells are ringing. It's a sign of things to come. There's this dark cloud starting to. It's.
And you know what's funny is I've seen this episode a good 8 to 10 times, and this is the first time I've ever noticed that she's not in this episode, which is the worst sign for Mandy. Like,
correct. She in the previous episode to this, which was 6 meetings before lunch, if I'm not mistaken. No, 20
I think
hours
that's
in
right
LA.
After this one.
20 hours in LA was the episode that preceded this, where Mandy is sort of not really doing very much in that episode. She's kind of does she go to LA with them?
I feel like she does, because isn't she like the one who agrees with the pollster who's having sex with Joey Lucas? Like, of course she's like the one. Maybe I'm like just grafting his opinion onto hers because that's always her role is to like. But maybe not. Maybe she doesn't go to LA.
I'm trying to remember. Anyway, she doesn't leave much of an impression in that episode. The six meetings before, she's also in that episode, but that's the episode where Lum-Lum.
That's the Lum-Lum, yes, of course.
So she's given Lum-Lum as her storyline.
Which is one of my favorite Mandy storylines, if only because she gets that great scene with Toby where he's feeling so good and he's like, "Nothing can bring me down." And she's just like, "I feel like we need to get a companion for Lum-Lum." Yeah. He's like, "That'll do it.
I need you to call China and get us some 2 pandas."
Like, at least that's funny. Like, if you're not gonna get anything substantive with Mandy, like, at least have a scene like that. That was great.
And then essentially the final thrust of her character really is on based on this memo that starts to circulate about her. So that's really kind of and a harbinger of things to, you know what I mean, of the sense that, like, she's not a team player, blah blah blah. I think she's unnecessarily maligned for her role in that whole thing.
I do too. Yeah.
But it is what it is. So this episode opens with Abby doing a television appearance with a student whose name escapes me. But
Jeffrey, I think.
Jeffrey, yes. Right. To talk about child labor. And Sam is watching this on TV with Abby's chief of staff, Lily, played by, what's the actress's name?
Her name is, as I have this right in front of me, and now, of course, I've scrolled past it. So all my preparation, Nadia Dajani.
Sure.
Who we were talking before we started recording.
We were, yeah.
She seems like a familiar face that maybe
totally.
I've only seen in a couple of things. I could have sworn she was on like multiple episodes of Sports Night, but apparently only one episode of Sports Night.
Okay.
But maybe it was a particularly memorable one. Like, who the hell knows? But like,
I just remember her from Sex and the City. I know she was Aiden's girlfriend post Carrie.
She gives Carrie the weird face. Look yeah, when the they're face. In the bathroom. But so a funny story about that though is that on the Carrie Diaries, the CW prequel series,
I liked it.
It was a really good show. Sad that it got canceled too early. Same. She played, I want to say, a girlfriend of Carrie's dad.
Okay.
Like, she shows up, and I remember being like, wait a second. Like, the streams are crossing. Like, what in the world's going on?
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure that's the character she played in. And again, it was just, like, one episode. But, like, maybe episode. Yeah. I wish she had been in more West Wing. I wish a lot of the guest stars on West Wing had been on more West Wing. But, like,
yeah,
she's a really interesting character. And it represents a really interesting sort of facet about Abby's character and the way she functions within this universe that I think is really kind of, you know, fascinating and interesting. I think when I was on the last time, we talked about the obvious comparisons to Bill and Hillary Clinton, that the Bartlett marriage sort of reflects and in some ways is reminiscent of, and in some ways is a pivot away from, I think an intentional pivot away from. But one of the things that is like definitional about Abby is she has her own career and she has her own ambitions and she has her own political sort of viewpoint. Like, obviously she's like was an integral part of the team to get, you know, her husband where he is today. But also this episode, the Hillary Clinton-ness of her character is very much present in the fact that she has a policy agenda. And I think, obviously, Hillary Clinton with healthcare was like a major, major, like the first time that we really had a first lady who had a policy agenda that was sort of specific and not like, I don't want to say like busy work, but like, you know, like Nancy Reagan had Just Say No and all this sort of shit and whatever. And Nancy Reagan is a whole other subject. But like,
she was given a real piece of legislation. Like, she was given.
Right. That's the thing. She was part of like, yes. Yeah. And I think, I think what this episode sort of does for the viewer is like we all sort of knew that Hillary had a policy to work with in the Clinton administration. But this one is just like, right, take it a step further. So if the first lady has a policy agenda, she's got a staff and she has people working for her. And maybe when her staff and the president's staff are at cross purposes, there's going to be some conflict. And I remember when I watched it the first time, I was like pretty fascinated by that. It was just like, oh, right. Like, of course, like she's not just one of the president's, one of the people working for the president. She's working also, you know, operating on her own track. And I think the argument that she and Jed have in the Oval Office at the end of the episode is, again, Sorkin being like, right, what if the Clintons, but what if, you know, Jed has that line about like, I won't be these people. I won't be people who stake out agendas on morning shows and send messages through the press. I'll drop my resignation off at the Capitol. And I think that was, again, Sorkin just being like, what if the president didn't want to operate, you know, the way that we thought that the Clintons operated, which was, because by this point, you're, you know, this is obviously many years from healthcare. This is the point where post Monica Lewinsky, Hillary's already, I believe, making a plan to run for Senate by the time this episode is in production. So, like, clearly, not only were the Clintons political animals maneuvering around each other, but by that point in history, they were moving almost at cross purposes to each other. Like, they were almost oppositional to each other. And there was a lot of that rumor about, like, you know, is she going to get elected to the Senate and then, like, drop a divorce paper on his, like, doorstep? I think that was one of the things people would talk about.
Well, it's, but, it's,
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that, because I do feel like, you know, Abby's character is interesting because I don't feel like that she particularly likes politics, right? Like, she doesn't radiate a sense of wanting to throw her weight around particularly. Feel like from
she's
time
not a
to
politician
time,
like Toby is. Like, she's not right. like or like Josh is, where right. she wants to like get her hands dirty and like maneuver and sort of like wheel and deal.
Yeah.
I think like she's a doctor and yeah. she's somebody who like, I think that makes a lot of sense. The areas in which she is passionate about certain things. And obviously child labor hits her hard because she's got three daughters and you know, that sort of thing. The thing she says at the end of the episode about how if that was one of our girls, you'd send in the Marines.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. And I think this episode sort of like draws a line to that distinction where it's just like she is operating in a world of politics, but she's not necessarily, she's not a wonk. She's not a mover and shaker.
Well, I think what's interesting is, so as we mentioned, she becomes a series regular in season two. Season two, they go all in on MS, right? I mean, the MS storyline becomes sort of this all-encompassing thing,
yeah.
Which is very smart because it pulls Abby into that universe, right? It's yeah. personal, but it's also the ramifications of this medical decision or medical decisions that she made. I just think it's interesting because it ultimately means she doesn't have to deal with agendas and politics and like her staff, right. and yet she's a major player in this universe. Because I think that if they, I guess what I'm getting at here is I don't know how gracefully these two things actually coexist. When yeah. she's having her big scene with Sam, and Sam's kind of, quite frankly, telling her the real about like the mistakes that she's made and what
right.
have you.
Right.
The look on her face is a person that's like, he's right. And right. I'm out of my depth. Like, this isn't really my thing. Like, what right. what do I have to do in order to fix this? It doesn't change, obviously, her feelings about the way that her husband has handled it. But I just don't think that they particularly align well, which is why I think the decision is very smart to have it, that her role in season yeah. two is much more of doctor and wife.
I think that's true. I think as somebody who, you know, likes what Stalker Channing's bringing to that
yeah.
character anyway, I think the idea of her as, you know, with a political agenda is intriguing to me regardless. I don't think sure. you're wrong. But I also think it's telling that the fact that three seasons after this, they essentially re-walk some of these beats. Like, yeah. Josh has a scene with Abby in season four, the episode where it ends up leading up to Amy gets hired as Abby's new yeah. chief of staff, where essentially it's very similar to the sort of talking to that Sam gives her, where it's just like, your staff isn't yeah. professional and you need to, if you want to get anything done, you need to take it seriously and yada, yada. And it's funny that, you know, it would repeat on itself that way. And essentially it almost felt like having to jumpstart that engine from scratch again, where it's just like, oh, right, we want to make, you know, Abby a little bit of a power player again. We need to essentially,
I think,
you know,
that
reboot this.
In a perfect world, perhaps, where they were able to sign Mary Louise Parker to be a series regular, I think right. there's a universe where that becomes a far more prominent storyline. Right. And, you know, would have loved to have seen that. I would have yeah. loved to have seen Josh and Amy, you know, lock horns over any number of issues.
Yeah.
You know, that we, that wasn't in the cards. But I yeah. do think that... So we see Sam talking with Lily. I want to kind of hone in on the Sam-Lily scenes, because I have to be honest when I say that, like, smug Sam, kind of my least favorite version
yeah.
of Sam.
Yeah, totally.
And I do feel like, and it especially rings poorly when he's talking to women.
Yes.
And in this episode, we get a couple of those scenes where it's like, like you can dial it back a little bit. Like you don't need to be such a dick. And he talks to Lily in shitty ways throughout the episode, I think.
I think because he's supposed to be the moral center of so many things that just like, well, I don't want my moral center to be also like a condescending like jerk so much. Like it wears better on Josh because there's a self-awareness on the show's part to being like, yeah, Josh can be a cocky asshole. Totally. That's sort of like his very first episode. The very first episode of the series is Josh got in trouble for being a cocky asshole on TV. Like, that's his character. And it's not Sam's character. And I don't know. I think Sorkin often likes to write towards a kind of Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn sort of, you know.
Yes.
To, like, bantering by you know, pecking at each other kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And sure, but I think there are dynamics in play that don't always serve that super well, especially when it is Sam. I think you're right.
Yeah, it's just interesting because like it feels like there's almost like, and I don't mean to make this seem so binary, but Sam has many modes, but I do feel like there's either like Sam with Mallory mode.
Yeah.
Which is like, or even Sam with like Ainsley Hayes mode, which is sort of flirty Sam, and he's being kind of playful and a little bit docile and being kind of the beta in that dynamic. And then there's the flip of that where it's like him talking to Lily or where you're just like, I just don't like this version of it.
Yeah.
But we basically, Lily asked Sam if Bartlett could skip going to the hill so that Abby could have the news cycle, which is insane. And then Bernie Dahl dies and no one has the news cycle. Yeah.
Right.
Bartlett's reticent to name Ron Ehrlich as the replacement because Abby went out with this guy in college. Okay.
Which is not something we find out until that final argument in the last scene, the nature of. And I, watching this again, I was like, well, it's been ages since the first time I watched this, but I wonder if the first time people watch this episode, you maybe wonder if this is maybe somebody that Abby cheated on Jed with, because the way he reacts when he's talking to Leo about it, when Leo first tells him that Bernie Dahl died, and do you want to, you know, name Ehrlich now and it'll settle the markets, and Jed says, no, I'm not ready to get in bed with Ron Ehrlich, which makes me one of the few people in my family who haven't. And when he said that, I was just like, well, that sounds like his mood is so dark in that moment that I'm just like, oh, there seems to be some genuine hurt. And also the fact that, like, if he's willing to stake the markets on this, like, it's got to be serious. And when you find out at the end that, like, Abby dated him for either 6 or 9 months, it is a bit in dispute. He then retroactively looks petulant and, like, kind of irresponsible. Like, and the other thing that I thought was, the Washington press in a real world situation would have flayed him alive for allowing the Dow to drop by waiting a day. Like, they wouldn't have known why he waited a day, but he would have gotten fucking excoriated by the press for doing so.
And then there's the whole fact that Ron Ehrlich's nickname was Skippy.
I couldn't tell whether that was a nickname or whether Jed was just being an asshole, but, like, that was...
Either way, it's dumb.
Yes,
it is. Yeah, it's weird. I guess there's something... I mean, it all feels kind of petty on Bartlett's side, obviously, on Jed's side. But it's also like it feels beneath both of them to even really be having this conversation.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of weird and very unlike Jed to feel this way, which I think underscores your point, which is that there's a hurt here that's perhaps deeper than they're giving us knowledge of. So then throughout this episode, Donna's reading a book from what life was like 100 years ago, which
is
sort of
a classic Donna runner. Like, it's one of it's out of the top 10, like, best Donna runners ever. Not even best, but just like most Donna thing to do is just like she's been reading a book and she's going to talk to anybody who will listen to her about it.
It's a very Donna runner. It's also a very Sorkin thing to sort of have this funny comedic runner, and then it kind of hits you with a gut punch when Charlie brings it up at the diner. Yes. So what feels like this cutesy sort of thing then all of a sudden hits hard. Is a nice sort of whatever C story runner, whatever it is.
Right.
I think that so Josh forces Toby to meet with these Democrats that are voting against this trade bill. Again, this is one of those situations. If you watch enough West Wing episodes, if Toby's happy about something at the beginning of the episode, you right. can guarantee that he will either not be happy by the end of the episode,
yes.
or the episode will be about how we might lose that happiness.
Right.
So, like, right. it's Toby being this confident is so unlike Toby that yes. you know it's going to go poorly.
He's, and it's something we'll learn about him in the flashbacks at the beginning of season two, where it's yeah. just like, he's somebody who is not used to victory in his political career. So it like, it's an odd, it can be an odd fit on him.
That scene at the bar
oh, yeah.
in The Shadow of Two Gunmen. How many yes. Elections have you won, including this one?
Yeah. None. It's great. And no, it's a great scene, and it's a great sort of building block to Toby's character, yes. too, where it's yes. just like it makes a lot of things make sense.
Yes.
But it's also the fact that, like, and you get this with Josh, too, a lot. This time it's Toby's turn to hate yeah. Congress, but, like, the sort of bone-deep hatred of the Congress is feels, A, realistic, and B, like, something yeah. that, like, you know, they kind of pass. It's like it's a ball that they pass back and forth to each other.
For sure.
This one's interesting because it's the fact that like that they want to get these congressmen because they are represent the sort of staunch liberal wing of the Democrats in Congress, and they don't want the story to be that they passed this trade bill, but that their base is, you know, upset with them. Which, sure,
yeah.
like that's a classic sure. communications office, you know, thing that's got to be, that's, you know, that's why Toby's involved. But it's also, it reminded me that like, we talked a little bit last time about how like, it's weird that people turn to Aaron Sorkin for political opinions because his politics are kind of unformed and all over the place. And like Aaron Sorkin on free trade is really, is a runner that sort of like comes up every once in a while again. And it's again, it's a vestige of the Clinton era where like in the Clinton era, free trade was sort of seen by the, you know, especially on the left as.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A universal good, and this is sort of, you know, that, you know, Clinton had made his bed, and he was, you know, all in on free trade and all that sort of stuff. And you see it again in the episode where Toby goes to show the kids how to protest, the episode with Roma Mafia as the cop, which is fantastic. But he talks about there about how like free trade stops wars, yada yada yada, all that sort of stuff.
I think it's interesting. In an upcoming episode, as I mentioned, Kerry Corrigan and I had a discussion about Aaron Sorkin's political bent, if you will.
Yeah.
He is sort of the quintessential boomer in this regard.
Absolutely.
Which yes. is that, you know, he literally just made a film, Chicago 7, about, you know, radicalism. But if you bring up Bernie Sanders to him today, he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's all
not go
relax.
That's
like crazy here. So it definitely does feel as though he's definitely gone through the boomer churn of the 60s were all about, we got to change it.
Yeah.
You know, 80s come around, we're getting really rich now, and then we're on the other side of
we're
the
80s. We're working within the system.
We're
a better capitalism, you know, a more, yes. you know, whatever, yes. compassionate capitalism, sure.
Yeah.
But it's always interesting to me that in the post-Sorkin era, that in the John Wells era, they had an episode where essentially Josh gets blindsided on a free trade bill
yes.
where all of these things that he had been promising the labor lobbyists and whatever about keeping jobs in the United States totally like goes against him, and all of these jobs get shipped off to India. And it's, I was like, oh, finally, at least the West Wing is confronting the idea that, like, after all of these, you know, free trade sort of, you know, one-sided boosterism, that's just like, oh, right, no, the downside to this is a lot of people's jobs go overseas.
And yeah, it's very strange. I mean, it is fascinating to watch this show through the prism of where we are now. Obviously, that's, you know, one of the myriad of things that is great about this show. You know, when you see sort of, you know, when the FEC positions open up in Bartlett, Let Bartlett Be Bartlett, this idea of, like, there's all these fundamental systemic things within America that this show is sort of really looking down the barrel of in the tail end of season one, where, you know, again, we're in 99, we're in the top of 2000, we're about to head into a very contentious election that, you know, arguably didn't really resolve itself. And creates any number of issues coming off of that election. It's hard not to, in a weird way, look at this season of TV as sort of really trying to be like, pay fucking attention to what we're talking about here. We're kind of at the tip of the spear, you know, when you look at Sam talking about privacy laws when it comes to the Mendoza appointment, when you see all these pieces of this season of TV, more so than season two, which is a lot more sort of, I don't want to say soapier, but a little less pointed. Because this isn't going into an election year, you can't help but feel a little bit like this show is really kind of saying, like, listen, please, like, they're shaking people.
Right.
And then you're like, fucking nothing happens.
Well, and then, and then all of a sudden politics becomes this, like, never-ending game of, like, oh, fuck, what's going on?
It's really interesting. And it makes me think back to Emily Vanderwerf's very, you know, salient issues with the show in terms of how we viewed the Obama years, right? Like, post Clinton, but more post W, that idea of, like, we've got it back, right? We've got a majority. We've got this, you know, transformative politician. It's all going to be good. And we've got our Bartlett. We've got the person who's going to systemically change everything. And then when he was unfortunately incapable of doing so, we then slipped into some fucking dark timeline.
Because, and I've read and listened to Emily on The West Wing, and, like, that is a incredibly salient and on target critique in many ways. But I think one of the things about that critique is, it's not just that, like, Aaron Sorkin was whatever, irresponsible or, you know, created an unrealistic vision. It's that the people who then watched The West Wing and then got jobs in government and sort of allowed that naivete to lead them perhaps to make some mistakes is, well, maybe you just weren't watching The West Wing closely enough, because, like, so much of The West Wing was that this frustration at the fact that they couldn't get all these things done. Like, yes, there was a big speech at the end and whatever, but, like, ultimately, they were frustrated by these things as often as they were successful at these things. And
I agree.
Ultimately, like, Sorkin's making a TV show and not sort of creating a society in, like, Sims or something like that. You know what I mean? Where it's just, like,
totally.
The satisfaction of the way that these plots would end with, like, the idea that a different showrunner writing a different show about politics would have ended storylines and episodes and whatever a lot more messily and a lot more unsatisfyingly. Like, you know, that, like, kind of, like, leave the audience on a bummer note of just, like, well, you know, that sucks. Like, you know, a little more cynical, if more realistic. That's a different show, and that's, you know, and I think that also has its downfall. I've you know, been obviously listening to these episodes that you've been doing, and I think one of the things that you bring up a lot is how House of Cards and Scandal is the other end of that spectrum, right? And those ones, yes, which are, like, ultra cynical, ultra, you know, pessimistic about the the goodness of public officials and the the ability for them to do good is, yes, true. But I also feel like that's also dangerous in its own way. I think the way that a show like House of Cards and Scandal, to a different degree, but like I think at some point when you're, you know, having the president murder a Supreme Court justice in her hospital bed, like you've maybe like left the realm of you know, political commentary. But I think something like House of Cards being so incredibly cynical, I think there's also a desensitizing aspect to that too, of just like, oh, well, of course these politicians are going to do the worst, most self-interested and vile thing possible. So why are we even surprised? That was the one of the things about the Trump era where everything like he would do is, and like there'd always be somebody being like, I don't know why we're surprised. And it's just like, yes, but we can still be like, yeah, we can still be furious about it, right? We don't have to necessarily let go of the part of ourselves that is like, there is an ideal here that is not being met, and I'm fucking mad about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've been doing these episodes, I have been thinking about what sort of the ideal political show that could exist right now is. I mean, I'd love to see what Liz Hannah's West Wing would look like. I'd love to see any number of writers who I obviously love and respect, and I think could come at this thing with an element of idealism, but a groundedness, and still make you believe in the possibility of government.
Right.
And would it be on broadcast television? Probably not. Yeah. But that's fine. Like I think that there is a great. There is another great political drama out there that finds a way to navigate these waters in a nuanced and intelligent and funny and heartwarming way. I think it's possible.
Yeah.
But I think that this show, for its time, for its moment, was just giving us the blueprint for it in a crazy way, or at least alerting us to issues that it was very prescient about and looking, you know, that's maybe of this final run of season one episodes. I was just really hit with the holy fuck, like, you know, the don't ask, don't tell, the FEC, the piracy, the privacy stuff, all this. I'm just like, oh my God, like, why is no one like listening to this stuff? And I'm not even sitting here saying that had Al Gore, I mean, he did win the election, but you understand my point. Had Al Gore actually been inaugurated and become, I'm not convinced that guy was the guy that was going to get us back, you know, to center.
That's a sliding doors future that I definitely would like to, you know, pursue and see what would happen. But Al Gore wasn't going to be the, you know, the utopia candidate either. And, you know, he would have faced a lot of opposition. And, but there's...
With Lieberman as his VP? Oh my God, what a world.
Jesus Christ. That's wild to think about. But, like, I do, like, for all of the, for as much as we talk about Aaron Sorkin, the idealist and sort of the fairy tale politics of the Bartlett White House, I do think there's more frustration there than we remember. And I think there's more, you know, and I think that's something that obviously the stretch of episodes that we're getting into with the West Wing definitely
for
deals
sure.
with.
And I mean, and Danny as well, who plays such an
this
important role
in this.
This
is a great Danny episode, by the way.
A great, like, Danny episode.
None of it is CJ stuff, which, like, I've talked about how I do like the Danny CJ stuff, but I like that they're giving Danny fun stuff to do that isn't that. I thought his scene with, well, first of all, the scene with Bartlett and Leo, where Bartlett's trying so ham-fistedly to get him to give up his source, and Leo's off in the corner just being like, for God's sake. It's so funny to me. Like,
yeah, it's a great
flavor of Leo. Yeah. It's a really great flavor of Leo.
For sure. I mean, Danny has... this is a great episode for Danny, and we'll unpack that in a quick second, but I just want to say that Danny is the voice in Let Bartlett Be Bartlett.
Yes.
He literally crystallizes for CJ and the audience
all
of the problems that are going on in this administration. Yeah. And you've been watching, you know, with Let Bartlett Be Bartlett, this episode 19, I believe, something along those lines, 18 or 19.
If this is 17, then that's 19,
Like, you've watched 19 episodes of a show invested in an administration that we think has been kind of effective, right?
Yeah,
and then you have Danny come out and be like, no. they've been fucking tripping over themselves the entire time.
It really recontextualizes that season. And it's and this was at a time where TV was still very, very, very episodic. And like there were, you know, obviously there were primetime soaps that, you know, had long going storylines, and TV dramas would carry over certain things episode to episode. But we were far, far, far still from the era of, you know, Lost unlocking TV's, you know, new era of serialization, right? But that episode was just like, oh, this has been building to a thing. And that's not always a thing that Sorkin does well. But like, whether by accident or by, you know, he managed to get that one right. Like, Bartlett B. Bartlett is just like, oh, right, like this all really was building up to something, yeah. And it got to a really, really good point.
And this tees up a lot of that, even if it's not doing it in maybe the most overt ways. But totally. When you look at the fight between Abby and Jed, it foretells us that there's going to be a big fight between Leo and Jed in the West Wing. In the Oval Office. The Oval Office really has a lot of Tempest in a Teapot, you know, fights in there. It's
Toby and Jed for the 17 people scene. Yeah. Yeah. But I thought the really telling line in this episode, and it's very quickly actually, and it maybe passes notice sometimes, is after their fight. When Abby says, I'm still going to kick your ass on child labor. And he sort of just kind of like sighs and it's just like, Abby. And it's that sigh of, you know, I can't do this good thing that you are telling me I need to do. And it's one of, and it's again, it's another example of the Bartlett White House like butting its head up against what is possible. And I think if there is an Aaron Sorkin consistent political viewpoint, it's a thing that Danny mentions in Bartlett B. Bartlett when he says, why are Democrats always so bumfuzzled? It's a thing that he brings up in other episodes and in other shows where it's just like, if Democrats would just be as aggressive and forthright about their progressive politics as Republicans are about their reactionary and sort of backwards thinking politics, they would do better. And whether or not that is true, it is to, like, talk to anybody who loyally votes Democrat and they will tell you that that's what they want their Democratic candidates to do.
Well, you just, you want, you know, I hate to say this because I feel like such a cliche, but the Republican Party has made a brand out of the perception of strength.
Yes.
The idea of we're going to fight, we're strong, you know, just this sort of red-blooded American kind of idealism. And the Democrats have always been seen as liberal, bleeding heart, not having that fortitude. I mean, it's and that's it's a branding issue is ultimately what it comes down to, that the Democrats just can't seem to stick to their guns on things to really feel like they're fighting for you. It's disheartening. But
it is. They're a party of calculation. They're a party of, and whatever, not to get into too much of a political discussion, it's easier. I think it's easier to be a Republican, to be a conservative, because all you have to do is sit on the ball and run out the clock.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Throw like sand that's in the gears. Yeah, that's it.
And Democrats have a lot other things that they have to like to move, and a lot bigger of a more diverse of a coalition to bring together, all that sort of stuff. Like whatever. Yeah. And I think that's something that Aaron Sorkin, that's a Gordian knot that Aaron Sorkin looks at and is like, well, just cut right through it. You know, why don't with, you know, verbally, you know, with, you know, with the power of, you know, these great, this great oratory. And it's not just oratory, it's conviction. I think that's the big Aaron Sorkin thing is if you would just stick to your guns and be forthright about this stuff, we'd all be better off. And he's maybe not wrong.
I don't disagree. I think that I think all that makes sense. I want to pivot for a second here because I do feel like one of the things about this episode that I didn't love was everyone talking down to CJ about learning the signs with Bartlett.
See, that's interesting. I think this is a really good CJ episode.
I don't think it's a bad CJ episode. I'm saying I think CJ is great. What I don't love is Sam being like, you gotta learn the signs, CJ, and hearing like, I don't love men talking to CJ.
I get that.
In this patronizing way. She's right in the end. She did read the signs correctly.
I think I see it a little bit less patronizing as that, like, that sort of, it almost feels like teammates and being like, you know, and she's sort of like, you know, she's not hitting her free throws, and they're just like, you gotta hit your free throws, like that kind of thing. And I think this episode combined with what happens in the next episode, which is one of my favorite CJ storylines of the season, which is she's got to deal with the Zoe thing where she lied about her classmate. And essentially what she's got to do is talk tough to the president and make sure that he doesn't go and blow up in front of the press. And that's another one where Sam's just like, you got to get up in his face. And she's like, get up in his face. But like, it's terrible CJ. Advice. It's not that CJ is like learning the job on the fly, but like it is her. It's a progression of her getting better and more confident in her job. And maybe it's annoying that like the most, like the one major female character in this administration has to get better at her job, whereas like seemingly Toby doesn't have to do that. Josh doesn't have to do that. Yeah. But I think it makes you root for her all the more. I think that's a big part of the reason why people love CJ so much is there is some self-doubt there, and there is some... There's an arc that she goes on, and she just gets better and better and better at what she does, and she learns the signs, and she learns how to get in the president's face and all this sort of stuff.
I agree with that. I think and that's an interesting interpretation and a fair one. I think that, having been doing a deep dive into all these episodes, I think there's just certain things that
there's
I'm
a pattern
kind of
for sure. Yeah.
On, you know.
Well, and once again, this is an episode where CJ doesn't know about a thing, where she's just like.
When she doesn't know
about economics, and to be fair, seemingly nobody but the president knows about economics, and like that's definitely a thing that comes up.
You brought up Zoe, I just want to kind of talk about this storyline, which is quite, you know, it's probably the B story.
It definitely is. This has my biggest logistical snag, which is
interesting. Okay,
it very much makes no sense that Zoe is the one who has to tell Charlie that there are being death threats made on his life. Like, that's a Ron Butterfield problem. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's, you know, the fact that it's not even the president, it's not Leo, it's got to be Zoe who has to, like, I get that it has to be Zoe to broach the, like, their relationship part of it. But, like, for Charlie to learn for the first time that there have been, like, threats made against his life because he's dating her should not come from her. And And I don't want to be like the nitpicker, but like that's a pretty significant one. Like that.
No, I don't. I don't
disagree.
Would
not have gone down like that. Yeah.
Well, so it's an interesting scene because Zoe's called into the White House, into the Oval Office. The president says it's time for me to tell you about some letters that we've been getting. He sort of, you know, lays out the situation and says you can't take Charlie to this club opening. Yeah. Which, by the way, I call bullshit on that more than anything. Like, the Secret Service can fucking figure it out.
Yeah.
But that's...
They at least had... What's her face? Georgia Fox. What can I remember?
Yes, Gina.
They at least had Gina sort of, like, go through the cursory, like, there's a back exit, we can't cover the alley, yada, yada, yada. It's just like, okay, like, whatever.
I mean, your ass. Whatever. Yeah. But yes. You know, and they didn't exactly prove their worth in the end of season four. So maybe we're all
true.
You know,
yeah.
We're all wrong. Yeah. But I do think that it's an interesting scene with, and to be fair, Jed does say, like, do you want me to tell him?
Right.
And she's the one that says, no, I want to tell him. I think that she likes to think, perhaps, that if it comes from her, he won't be as upset about it.
Yeah.
Spoiler, that doesn't go well.
Right.
She tells him about it. They're having lunch in a diner, the same diner that they from ER, yet again.
Very useful diner. Yeah.
It's a very useful diner. And basically he blows up. And then we have the callback to the 100 years. And he says, look at this. Yeah. Turns out 100 years ago, a black guy couldn't go out with his white girlfriend at fear of being killed. So there, it's again, you know, Dulé Hill, just amazing with just these unbelievably emotive eyes. And you're just like, he's just so wonderful.
Yeah.
And him and Elizabeth Moss have such wonderful chemistry.
Yeah.
So he gets pissed off. He goes back to work. And Danny Kincannon is waiting outside the Oval Office to talk to Bartlett.
Part of a triptych of scenes where Danny just like has scenes with other, like, it's like, it's Mrs. Landingham, it's Abby, it's Charlie. It's just like,
it's
all
fantastic.
Of a sudden,
it's
like
great.
Danny's just like hanging with the crew. It's really fantastic.
Right. And Mrs. Landingham has a great moment where
she's
going to
give him a cookie.
Yeah. She's going to give you a cookie. It's fantastic. But he senses that Charlie's kind of pissed off.
Yeah.
Charlie explains to him that he can't go to this club. And Danny gives him really good advice. He says, if it's me right now, I'd make sure I'm the one guy in her life that's totally hassle-free. It's a really beautiful scene where he says, like, listen, man, I know you're upset. I get why you're upset.
Yeah.
It's not Zoe's fault that you're upset. Right. It's great.
It's a really good scene from that perspective. If there's anything that I have a little bit of a snag on, it's that is a moment, not specifically that, but like Charlie's storyline in this episode is a moment where it really feels like, oh, it would have been nice if the show had other black characters that Charlie could have talked to about this. Because like it, you really feel the lack of that in this episode where it's just like Charlie's got to deal with this all by himself. And while Danny does give him very good advice when it comes to Zoe, it really, really would have been good to have him be able to. There's a scene in season 5 where one of the more maligned characters who I always stick up for is Angela Blake, when they bring on Angela Blake in season 5.
Yes,
who,
yes.
Who, when Josh gets sidelined and they've got to deal with the majority leader and they shut down the government. She ends up having, in an episode, a scene with Charlie where they just sort of talk about, and she invites him to like a party at her house. That was the episode with Gabrielle Union, which is like an annoying storyline, an annoying episode. But I was like, oh, this is amazing. We're 5 seasons into this this show, and Charlie gets to have a scene with another black character, and it's like, and it's really, really refreshing because it's just like, oh, holy shit! Like, there's a side to him, and there's a, you know, there's a perspective there that can be shared by them, and it's again when you talk about like this is why diversity on television is not a checklist. This is not why it's just like get to do it to get people off your back and to avoid getting canceled or whatever. It's because you can unlock these doors with these characters and give them perspectives and give them, you know, sides to themselves. And that's, if there was one thing I would have wanted out of that storyline in that episode, it's just like, oh, if only Charlie could have had somebody else to talk to who would have known what he's going through.
100%. It would have been interesting if Gina was black, quite honestly.
100%.
I think
totally.
that would have, you know, it would have unlocked, to your point, a whole bunch of stuff, which I think would have been really interesting.
Yeah, I
don't disagree. I mean, I'll say this, though. When Charlie does open up to our characters, which he does periodically, if it is Josh, if it is Danny, if it's whoever, they're really beautiful scenes. And I think that this scene with Danny is a really charming, lovely scene, which then leads to a great joke in the Oval Office where he's like, I just gave some salient advice about Zoe to Charlie. And Bartlett says, so you're helping my my assistant score with my daughter. That's great. Thank you, Danny.
It's
that stuff's great.
That I like is when Abby comes into the Mrs. Landingham's portion of the office and she sees Danny and she's like, are you here for the Michigan Women's Democratic Caucus? And he's like, I'm actually here to see the president. And she looks at him and like, once you know what's going on, it's just like, he's on to what's going on. And they sort of like share a look between each other where he's just like, yeah. And she's just like, okay. And I don't know. It's really good. It's
great. It's a scene that there are a couple of scenes that Danny gets in the Oval Office with Bartlett that have a similar flavor, which is just sort of this, like, we went through an election together. He talks to him about all the different places, all the different, you know, late night conversations that they had. And I find the campaign, the election campaign, so fascinating. It's one of the reasons I love season 7 of this show.
Yeah.
It's just like being in the trenches, being out there in the world. And I imagine that running for re-election is a very different thing than running for that first election, right? Like the mindset of a president who's trying to get re-elected as opposed to a person who's trying to become the president. It's two different things.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by that idea of like what those late night conversations between Bartlett and Danny must have been like.
Yeah. Well, and he also mentions, he says, you literally wrote the book on my wife, which is a thing that like, I always sort of forget that like, oh, apparently Danny wrote a biography of Abby Bartlett. And I kind of wish that had come up. You never really hear about that again. And all of the times where like she and Jed are having problems or whatever, and there's, you know, all this stuff. I was like, and Danny kind of goes away for a while too, as many West Wing side characters do. One of the things that I noticed, by the way, well, anyway, I'll finish this thought. Just would have been cool to have, you know, any kind of like moment where like Danny revisits that connection.
Yes, yeah. Totally.
But one of the things I looked up in this too, because I kind of mentally went down the road of just like, whatever happened to Zoe and Charlie anyway, because they break up fully off screen. Mm-hmm. Do you know she's gone from like early season two until mid season four?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Elizabeth Moss doesn't show up on the show for like almost for like a season and a half, and it's just
When she shows back up, she's well,
she's with Jean-Paul all of a sudden.
She's with Jean-Paul, like, and Josh has that line. Wow, Zoe really grew up, didn't she?
But it's so funny because she's such a big part of the latter half of the first season, and then such a big part of the early episodes, the first couple episodes of season two, and I think in my mind, it's just like, yeah, Zoe's always just like bopping in and out and around. No, like, oh no, like she fully went away and they broke up off screen and you never really find out why.
And it's a testament to Elizabeth Moss, obviously, and to Dooley Hill. But I mean, Elizabeth Moss is so good in the role. I mean, listen, not to, you know, everyone knows that Elizabeth Moss is one of our greatest actors right now. Yeah. So it's like, it's no surprise, but she's really tremendous. There's also, we'll get to it at the very end, because the last scene they have together is adorable, but
it is.
I want to talk about, you know, the real kind of jewel in the crown of this episode, which is, Abby and Jed in the Oval Office.
Yes.
This sort of final bout that these two have, which the whole episode really is barreling towards. Like, there's an inevitability of just how Jed is trying desperately to sort of navigate this chess match so he doesn't have to have this conversation.
Right.
But there's no way around him. And the way she barrels into the office, and it's just like, sugar puff.
Yeah, hello, like, gumdrop. It's just like, ah! Gumdrop.
It's just like, you know it's coming. And they're both just like fucking titans. They're such heavyweights that it's just great.
It's, if I'll compare it to watching an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race at a bar with the final lip sync, where they'll pull off a move or whatever, and everybody will just like fucking like flip out, and that's sort of how I feel inside when she says, what does she say? She's just like, when she says, you said it yourself. If I appoint Ron Erlich like I was going to do, it sounds like I'm taking instructions from my wife. And it's just like, this is fucking
it's the best fucking bonkers delivery.
It's so great.
It's so great. She's, I mean, both of them are so specific in the way they speak.
Yes.
So it's really just these two like dialects that are kind of coming at each other.
Oh my God.
It's
perfect.
Really, really special. It's really interesting too, how like, she tries to kind of warm it up a little bit. Like, she doesn't really just come in swinging, but then it's the slow boil, and he actually breaks before she does. Like, there's this, like,
they both have their moments, but
earlier than her,
yes,
and he kind of gives up the game. And I would argue that if this was actually a physical match, he kind of he went too hard too fast, and she's like waiting him out, and then just like
she let it she rope-a-dopes him a little bit. Yeah, totally.
It's great. It's really great.
But there's moments where both of them sort of realize that they've lost this one. They've lost their little argument on points. And you can see it where, like, she's just like, oh, yeah. Like, yes, you know, I was wrong. And then he will also get to a point where he's just like, wait, what are you saying? What are you taking responsibility for?
What's really happening?
And it's a really interesting argument that way, because it has such a flow to it. And it has, and then they reach such a great part at the end where, you know, he says, like, that's our first Oval Office fight. And then they end up talking about Zoe and leaving sort of arm in arm. And it's just like, oh, right, this is a great marriage. They can sort of have it out and still have that, like, baseline love and respect for each other that, you know, it's not going to, like, break them to have this kind of a fight.
It makes me think about another show that has, I would argue, the only successfully functional marriage that I love, which is Friday Night Lights. I think that the Taylors... somehow, I mean, and I guess it Parenthood has it to a certain extent as well, but and you know, as Sarah Watson spoke of on a previous episode, there is a similarity between Kadams and Sorkin in terms of the good they see in people.
Yeah.
The idea of people being good isn't necessarily bad television. I'll come back to that at the end because there's another show I want to talk about in this regard too. But I just think that seeing these two duke it out, having their first fight, leaving arm in arm, it's all okay, mm-hmm. is a testament to how solid their marriage is. Like, yes. I don't think that at any point Aaron Sorkin or any of the writers want you to question that this marriage is bulletproof. Right. It's not to say that they're not going to have their fights.
Right.
They will, but they're always going to figure out a way through it.
Yes.
And that's an amazing thing, especially yeah. considering what they go through through season 2 and 3 specifically.
Yeah.
It is really fascinating. At the end of the episode, Charlie goes to Zoe's dorm room with flowers and some videotapes.
Yeah.
That's
also like classic 99. Like we hadn't quite tipped the scales fully to DVDs yet. So it shows videos. Up with videos.
Yeah, it's great.
It's very cute. Yeah.
There's a great little couplet that I love. Zoe says, "Are there other things you feel bad about too?" Charlie says, "Yes." Zoe says, "Name them, please."
Yeah.
It's
cute.
It's adorable. It's perfectly delivered by Elizabeth Moss. And
I love that they're doing it for an audience of Gina, who, like, that's another fascinating thing that, like, oh, right, Gina just, like, has a dorm room at Georgetown that she's just, like, can be across the hall and see what's going on at all times. Yeah.
It's great. And then she walks down the hall and says, "Book bag is in,
for the night.
Yeah. It's great. The other show I wanted to talk about, which I've been rewatching in preparation for season 2, is Ted Lasso.
Oh,
and
sure.
And I want to bring it up because it comes back to what I was just saying in terms of Friday Night Lights, Kadams, and being good.
Yeah.
I think that there's this unfortunate sort of, I mean, truthfully, jadedness that we have now.
Yeah.
Rewatching Ted Lasso, which has just been absolutely flooring me this second time around, where I'm just like, this show's just unreal.
Yeah.
People think that it's saccharine. People think that it's too aw shucks, that it's too sweet. Not this show. The notion of people being good.
Yeah.
And I think it's why we're so lost. I think it's one of the reasons why I feel like we are where we are right now as a country.
Yeah.
Where, like, seeing the best in people, striving to be the best version of yourself, should be a no-brainer. And yet,
it's one of those things, and I think you're seeing it more and more, where, like, if a show can pull that off, it feels more and more radical.
Miraculous.
Another show that's on right now that I'm paying a lot of attention to is The White Lotus, which is Mike White's new show, and a lot of it reminds me of Enlightened, which was a previous HBO show of his. And that one, obviously, I don't think anybody would ever call that show saccharine, but the thing that was so audacious about that show was the central premise of that show was Laura Dern's character wants to be a good person, and the whole struggle is, how can I find and hold on to this ideal good person that is inside of me when the whole rest of the world is trying so hard to push all my buttons and to frustrate me and to make me sort of stray from that path? And it does so in a really kind of smart way, but I thought that was one of the first times where I was just like, oh, you can make the pursuit of just goodness as its own thing to be a thing that can drive something like a television show. And
I that's a really interesting comparison, because I do think that Mike White's stuff is brilliant for a myriad of reasons, but I do think that sort of deconstruction of what motivates a person to want to be better. I think that Laura Dern is doing it for all the right reasons. She's failing in some regards, she's succeeding in others. And I think that Ted Lasso is another example of that, of people that are all sort of cloaked in their own versions of quote unquote failure. And trying to find the best versions of themselves, or at least to find to surround themselves with people that make them the best versions of themselves. And I think that this comes back to the West Wing, because I think that it's easy to say this show is naive and this show is idealistic and this show is saccharine and it's all these things. But first of all, there's a courage in that.
Yes.
There's also a courage in seeing the flaws in yourself and wanting to be a better person for it.
Yeah.
And I think that we just need more shows like this. I just, it's more shows like Ted Lasso, more shows that sort of embrace the brokenness of the human condition, but the idea of striving for better. I understand that perhaps there are people that did not take the last 14, 15, 16 months of their lives as we were all trapped inside to look inwards and to try to say, like, these are my weaknesses, these are my strengths. I get that.
Right.
A lot of people, that's too scary and they're just not interested in doing that.
Yeah.
But I really do think that that on some level it's television's job through entertainment to try to get people to look within themselves. I remember when Friday Night Lights went off the air, many moons ago, I was hired by Jason Kadams to be his assistant, and I couldn't take the job because of my immigration status. It was a real watershed moment for me. But I had his email address, so I emailed him when the show was done to tell him how much I loved the finale. And one of the things I said to him is that, you know, that show so beautifully illustrated that idea, right? Mm-hmm. Of looking at people that you that teach you about yourself and can hopefully make you into a better person.
Yeah.
What more can we strive for? Yeah. And this is a television show trying to show a country, trying to literally be like, this could be you if you, you know, listen.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But
one other thing I wanted to bring up before because Amy Aquino plays Becky Reisman, plays the congresswoman who's going to attach the rider to the bill. Mm-hmm. And one of the great sort of character actresses who, even if you don't know her name, you've seen her in something. So like, I'm pretty sure the first thing I ever saw her in, she's Melanie Griffith's new assistant at the end of Working Girl, who has that really great scene with her. But, like, she's Sam's mom in Freaks and Geeks. She's Felicity's counselor on Felicity.
She's Dr. Coburn on ER.
On ER. She's, I did watch a season of Bosch for work, and she's definitely on Bosch.
Okay.
I just literally was catching up on Falcon and the Winter Soldier. She's in that show. She's
I saw your tweet about the sound design.
Oh my God, it was driving me crazy. I'm like jostling with the remote. And finally, I gave up. Yes. And I'm just like, I'm turning on closed captioning. And that's all there. Because, like, what can I do?
Enough, yeah.
But one of my very favorite character actresses, and this is, again, it's, you know, it's a one-off West Wing episode. We never see Becky Reisman again. But it's a really great scene. And it's one of those things where she projects, even when her character is being a pain in the ass and being sort of short-sighted, and she projects an intelligence, and it doesn't take you long to believe that, like, she has her reasons, and she does have her reasons. She, as a self-interested congresswoman, because of, I would say also, the mistakes that Abby makes by sort of, like, not running this decision to go on television about the child labor thing by anybody, now this congresswoman thinks, oh, I'm the child labor advocate in Congress, I can't let this thing become a thing in the public eye without me being at the head of it. So now I've got to do this thing.
And no, I totally agree with you that, like, the casting on this show is tremendous, but roles like this, where we have to buy into something in a very short period of time that has a big ripple effect, has to be done by a person, to your point, of this kind of stature, right? Where Sam and her can meet in a gym and she can be like, so I'm doing this.
Right.
And as an audience, you have to be like, yeah, no, I mean, I buy it. I don't know why, but I buy it.
But exactly.
Yeah.
Also, Abby mentions about, like, we're not on Steve's boat anymore. And, like, clearly the implication is that, like, she and Jed and Becky and her husband are friends that sort of go way back. And every once in a while, the West Wing will sort of, and obviously the stuff with Ron Ehrlich too, is just like, it makes me, like, there's a Bible out there somewhere that has, you know, these characters' histories, and, like, clearly, and it makes me want to almost, like, the West Wing, the college years, where just, like, it's fascinating to me, the idea of, like, what Jed and Abby's life would have been like when they were young, when they were college age. There's another episode, I know I bring up Amy Gardner all the time, but, like, where Abby's like, I used to babysit for you. And it's just like, that's fascinating to me that, like, now they go all the way back. And obviously, like, Amy dating Josh's roommate at Yale Law School or whatever. And it's just like,
yeah, I mean, I'd pay all the money in the world for someone to do
that's
some sort of
I would take
series.
That over a West Wing continuation
revival,
or sequel.
Yeah.
Like, West Wing prequel, I'm all in on it.
Yeah, like 100%. Yeah. I would. I mean, even just like him running for governorship, right? He was the governor of New Hampshire.
Yeah, you know
that sort of stuff. Yeah, totally. there's something. Yeah, I would watch
that. You'd have to recast Mrs. Landingham, and that would be tough to like. There's so much pressure on whoever would have to play that role because like she's so beloved. But I guess there would be pressure on everybody.
I feel like it's funny we say this because this October we're going to get a prequel to The Sopranos in the form of a movie.
Yeah,
I'd watch a prequel movie of The West Wing.
Yeah, I definitely.
I mean, and on some level, I feel like that's almost more palatable or possible for Aaron Sorkin to do.
Yes.
Than
well, and it would keep him from doing the thing that we most don't want him to do, which is comment on the state of politics in 2021.
Correct.
Like,
correct.
That's what we don't want.
And by the way, he would probably embrace it, right? Because all the things that he wants to say that are politically incorrect or don't sound right would be perfect.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he could just be like, well, it's 1987, so like, whatever.
Everyone's like, fine, sure, okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, I would watch the hell out of that. I do have one final question for you. I know that in our previous episode, I asked you what your favorite episodes of The West Wing were.
Yes.
So my question to you now is, who are your favorite characters on The West Wing? Do you have any that did work for you? Okay.
I mean, in terms of regular cast, because like I've talked about like
even deep cuts, I'm open to support. You know,
I love recurring. Again, I've talked a ton about how much I love Amy and how much I love Abby. Main characters, like, it can't go wrong with CJ and Toby. Those are like, I feel like those are like, that's where the show exists for me. And they're the best. Deep cut characters. God, there are so many. When I was at the Atlantic, we had done a ranking of like all of them where we got into like, what's also, it's so funny that I've done two episodes and Margaret hasn't shown up on either one of them. Cause like,
it's true.
God knows I love Margaret. And
I mean, Let Bartlett Be Bartlett's got a big, huge Margaret runner in that one.
Oh, is that the one where, her friend on the President's Council for Physical Fitness who,
The recipe for the muffin that fucks up the whole email system.
She's the best. God, I love Margaret. Even in like getting into like later season stuff, like I loved the Janine Garofalo character who they brought on in season 7. I thought she was like really fantastic. Yep. That's season 2, Larroquette. I was going to say John Larroquette, who amazing. Again, in my memory for the longest time, I was like John Larroquette had like a 6 episode run on The West Wing. It's like, no, he's on one episode, but like he's so fantastic in that one episode.
Yeah. As is Oliver Platt's another great recurring. Yeah. I mean,
Platt has some good scenes with Stalker Channing too. Like they have some like really, really fantastic stuff. But yeah, I would argue that
the dictaphone that won't turn off is one of the most classic Sorkin
first
things
scene,
ever.
His like that's how they introduce the guy. It's great. But yeah, CJ and Toby, I think, and like that's a very like kind of two sides of a coin thing, right? Where like she's, you know, again, she's learning on the job. She's sort of on the way up. I think Toby's obviously much grumpier. She is more outwardly. She ends up being the idealism of Sam almost wears better on her. There's the episode where she talks about there's the mad cow scare, and she has that thing about how, and it's a thing that very much resonates in COVID vaccine times, where she's just like, information breeds confidence and silence breeds fear and that kind of thing. And just like essentially trust the American public with this information and they will, you know, you'll see the best of them. And whether that is true, I think that it makes CJ maybe the most idealistic of anybody. And
I totally agree.
Toby's a lovable grump.
it's funny that you bring that up because in a previous episode, which I'm sure you remember, the whole Lowell Lydell situation and the Matthew Shepard-esque sort of situation that transpires there and the relationship with the parents and all of that. Yeah. In that episode when we were talking about it, and forgive me, I can't remember which one it was, but
check out the trash day, right?
Yes, I believe you're right. Yes. Yeah. And she gets quite emotional. And I was talking with the guest, Carrie Whitmer, about sort of this dynamic of that women are allowed to be emotional and quote unquote men aren't.
Right.
But I feel like periodically you'll get Toby who can get a little choked up. He can get a little bit emotional depending on the circumstances. The largest one being when his kids are born at the end of season four.
They share such a great look in that scene, too.
It's the best, where she just is Toby.
She puts her hand on her heart a little bit.
Oh, my God. It's great. It's the best. It's just, that's the stuff that I feel like that's the goods. And you're right that Toby and CJ share that brain.
It's funny that you bring up the Lowell Idell thing, because I think that was probably a big part of the reason why I kind of imprinted on CJ early, because that was such a, like, kind of ripped from the headlines thing, where like the Matthew Shepard incident was not too long before that happened. I want to say that was maybe 98 at the latest.
It was 98. And then this happened in 99. And then I was, it took 10 years for them to pass something.
Right. And I remember I was obviously 18 years old then and still very closeted. But like that one hit me hard. And I remember like I have this very vivid memory of watching the funeral that like CNN had like cameras at the funeral with like the West the Fred Phelps people protesting the funeral and sort of having like the God hates fags like signs at the funeral, and it like I really really emotional stuff to watch sort of all by myself, right? And I remember then when they did that episode of The West Wing and like watching CJ be that emotional, I was just like, oh okay, like somebody else gets it, sort of, you know, and is experiencing that to some degree the way it sort of felt for me. So I was just like, well, now CJ's on my team, you know what I mean? Like,
well,
CJ's,
that's the thing,
yeah,
that really is sort of, I mean, that's kind of in the DNA of the character, which you mentioned earlier, and I couldn't agree with you more that that's such a hallmark of why we love her.
Yeah.
She's always fighting for the underdog, it seems. Yeah. She's all, you know, even in The Women of Kumar, you know, an episode that, you know, some people might think is not particularly delicate or nuanced in the way that it's dealing with things.
Right.
That scene she has with oh my God, why am I drawing a...
Well, also Anna Deavere Smith, like you talk about favorite characters, like that is like... Nancy McNally is top three for me. Like, she's absolutely so top three for me. She's one of my absolute favorites.
That scene they have together where CJ's like, they're beating the women.
Yeah.
And Nancy just walks away. Like, there's just like, I don't know what, I can't fix it. There's nothing I can do about it.
Yep.
I hear you. We're doing, it's just, it's great stuff. And she was also the number two choice for CJ Craig, was in a diverse.
Oh, right, because essentially
it was those two. Yeah.
She was the press secretary and American president.
Yeah, so they were just like, and I mean, I'm sure she would have been great too.
Oh, yeah.
But Nancy McNally is fantastic. Whenever she shows up, especially during the whole kidnapping, is just fantastic.
Her first episode is the first episode of season two, right, where she like walks into the Situation Room and she's coming from a party and she's like, can somebody get me a change of clothes? I feel like an idiot here. It's just like, it's so great.
It's fantastic. It's all that stuff is great. She's great. Fitzwalls is also another phenomenal supporting recurring character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the bench of this show. This is one of, I guess this is what it's like when you're the Yankees, I guess, you know, or something to that effect.
Right,
you know what I mean? Where it's just like, you're the top tier. All the top tier people are just like, yeah, sure. What do I need to do?
Yeah.
I'll do my one episode and take home an Emmy for guest star or whatever.
Although weirdly enough, you would think that, except that like for as dominant as The West Wing was in the supporting actor categories at the Emmys, I think maybe they had one guest actor. Like, you would think that they would have dominated the guest actor categories, and they never did, and it was always so baffling to me.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. For whatever reason, the guest actor at that time was all, like, Law & Order guest stars and probably NYPD Blue and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was always fascinating to me that, like, that's where the line that, like, everybody and the show would win a bunch of Emmys. Martin Sheen never did, and none of the guest stars. It was just like, that's so strange. I don't know, man.
It is interesting to see how, especially considering the Emmy nominations that just came out, it does feel like there was a time when the Emmys were actually relatively good about spreading the love. They wanted The Sopranos to take home some big awards.
Right.
They wanted The West Wing to take home some awards. Now, they expand categories to nominate more people from the same show.
You want to hear me talk for an hour and a half about the Emmys, where I was just like, I love Ted Lasso.
Yeah, sure.
All those actors on The Handmaid's Tale are very, very good actors, but we don't need to have categories of eight nominees where half of them are from the same show. It's just like, sounds like you've only seen five television shows this year.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not a great look. The Crown and Ted Lasso are both two of the best shows on TV. That goes without saying. They're going to win a bunch of awards. And it's not to say that I don't want to see these people recognized. It's just more that, like, you know,
there's a lot of television out there.
There's a lot of television out there. And I would argue, and I'm very curious as to hear your thoughts on this. I'm assuming we think similarly on this, which is the only good thing about awards is the exposure that it can give to things that might not be seen otherwise.
Yes.
I don't need to give awards to people that we all recognize as top tier brilliant people in town.
Right.
You know, as lovely as that might be, I want to give it to the little thing that might not get seen otherwise. And that people go, huh, that's interesting. Which is why ultimately I would argue that the Academy Awards from last year was a great thing. I love the fact that Nomadland won, and I love the fact that a bunch of smaller movies won a bunch of awards. That's fantastic.
Right.
It's frustrating as hell to see that just not being brought to bear.
It's the conflict between should award shows be a reflection? Am I watching an award show to have a reflection of my own taste reflected back to me, or am I watching an award show to sort of, you know, to get a sense of what the landscape of television or movies are? And it's one of my favorite things. For, you know, I'm crazy into, you know, movies, obviously, but like I'll still watch, you know, like the Independent Spirit Awards and be like, oh, this is a movie I've never heard of. Like, I want to seek this thing out now. And
it's why Cannes is so important as well, to see a movie like Titan, which I'm very curious to see. It sounds bug nuts, but I'm there. But, you know, it's funny. I think there's a third category to what you were saying that is the unfortunate reality, which is that I think that these award shows, unfortunately, are still an attempt at getting ratings. So they want big things to get nominated that a lot of people have seen so that they pay attention or watch the award show, which, again, is just like it's all dissonant noise otherwise. Like, what's the point?
This is why I always say I, you know, for as conflicted as I am about Netflix, I long for the day that the Oscars move to Netflix so that they can be 5 hours long and don't have to worry about ratings.
Wow, that is a bold. I don't know if I put it on Netflix, but I put it on a streamer, that's for sure.
Something like that, right, exactly. Something where you don't have to worry about, like, you know, whatever your number's gonna be, you know, the next day.
That's actually a really, really smart. So if someone was smart, that's what they do. Yeah. If Peacock was smart, they'd be like, here's a Brinks truck of money, you know, no commercials, we'll just, you know, pay-per-view,
whatever. Do what you want to do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Bizarre. Joe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Yes. I hope that you'll come back in the future for future television, depending on shows that you've seen or like or what have you.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough for doing this again. It's truly wonderful.
Thank you, Phil.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.